Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
This is Burning Down the House on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. Today I want to vary a little bit from our usual fare of architectural talk. Our guest today is Dan Weldon, who is a master printmaker. Dan, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, thank you.
Hello, Curtis. How are you today?
Very well, thanks. It's a nice foggy, sort of London fog, Turner-esque kind of day here in Brooklyn.
Uh-huh.
And what better time to talk about printmaking? And in no particular order, these are some of the things that I'd like to talk about with you. A little bit about your background. I definitely want to hear about your solar plate printing. Overall, as a sort of a theme, I want to talk about the balance of technique or technical considerations with form. And if you'd like to, well, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, I'm very happy to. It's actually a little bit foggy here, too, out in Sag Harbor. But I'm sitting next to my nice cozy fire because it's just a nice glow, and especially a day like today. And I love being in the woods, actually, and that's where I live, away from, I don't see a neighbor, and that's part of my lifestyle of being an artist, I think, because I like being having solitude and quiet when I'm working. So doing that and being in an environment where it's really conducive and yet it's also close enough to New York and close enough to good cultural things that I can access very, very readily. But I've been doing my art for my whole life, but I developed a strong interest in printmaking when I went to school in Munich, Germany, because I met a man there who was very instrumental and very guiding. He happened to know a very distant uncle that and he sort of opened up the doors because of that acquaintance. And we became friends, and he was the most important person in my artistic development. His name was Kurt Lowasser.
Uh-huh.
So he taught me how to open my eyes and to see not only in terms of drawing and painting, but a very interesting inventiveness that he was able to. He would give me questions and riddles and pose problems for me to try to figure out, which were always challenging. So that gave me an opportunity to think beyond the box and get out there.
Well, that sounds wonderful. Well, the Germans are master printmakers throughout history, going back to even before Dürer.
Yeah. Well, they learned how to do it. I guess that discipline helped them as the Italians excelled in painting and sculpture. The Germans did the printmaking thing. But in other parts of the world, too, printmaking developed very nicely.
So as I understand it from looking at your website, I hadn't actually ever asked you about this. You have been able to collaborate with some fairly well-known artists out from the Hampton scene, haven't you?
Yes, I was very fortunate. It actually started before I moved here. I worked for Tanya Grossman at ULAE and worked with Rauschenberg and Rivers and Johns and Motherwell and Saul Steinberg, and at the same time I had my own press and started developing a little bit of my own studio, and I started working with people that I knew or got to know, and they included Willem de Kooning and Elaine de Kooning and Dan Flavin, Jimmy Ernst, and more recently Eric Fischel, who's been really terrific to work with, and I worked with Kurt Vonnegut and, a host of other people.
I wasn't aware that Vonnegut did art.
He did. Yeah, he was not only did art, but he was just a fun guy to work with. What a sense of his personality and his humor. Just really was just something I looked forward to all the time. And right, I'm actually working today with a good friend of mine, Roy Nicholson, and we're doing some very interesting solar plates combined with monotype, and which means it's a combination of an etching and doing a one of a kind squashed painting, combining them together, and each piece becomes very unique. It really shows a very strong spirit of printmaking, as opposed to, say, one of the things that you were, I think, getting at was the idea of technicality as versus form, and it requires both, in my eyes, to make art. I mean, you need to have discipline on one hand and then emotion on the other hand. So if you put these two elements together, then you're making art in any form. And you could substitute other words for them. They could be emotion and structure. It's just like hot, cold, good, bad, heaven, hell. These yin yang kind of philosophies that make art.
Well, then, what do we do with people like Andy Warhol, who himself didn't actually really do much of the technical stuff?
Well, he had the concepts. He had the ideas. I never had the privilege to work with him, but he was doing something. I mean, he was making his artistic statement because he was being different than anybody else that had ever done anything. I mean, he wasn't doing portraits in a normal kind of fashion.
Right.
He was doing them in a very odd kind of way, and yet you knew who they were. And he was having. I bet he was having a lot of fun. And I think that's really, the bottom line when you're doing art is to learn how to make and have fun and learn how to play while you're doing art. Because although some of my colleagues and friends, they disagree with me, they feel that they have to struggle and sweat and work hard and all that, which is fine. I think I started out that way until I learned from some of my students to work a little bit with more of a playful approach, and that's what I really like doing. I like the unknown, the adventure of the not really knowing where it's going to go, and then finding out, an aha moment that comes along.
I think there's a lot to be said for enjoying yourself. I'm wondering, since you did know the Koonings, I wonder if you had ever met the sculptor Tony Smith.
I never did. No, I would have loved to.
Because apparently he ran with that crowd also.
Yeah.
Although I guess he would have been maybe 10 or 15 years older than you. I worked for his brother Tom when I was an architectural intern, and Tom Smith and his wife Graziella had, as far as I could tell, they had the best time. I mean, they really knew how to live.
They had fun.
They did have fun, and and yet, Tom was a serious architect, but their quality of life, although it seemed to be rather like they were kind of broke all the time. Maybe they weren't. Maybe they were just having a good time.
Yeah.
They live very simply, but they live very well.
Well, I don't know if I ever told you, but I was originally planning on becoming an architect. But I found out that I had to do math, so that went by the wayside rather quickly. And it was really one of those things that it wasn't fleeting. It was actually quite a while, and it was very serious. Because, I think anybody that knows how to really draw and has discipline, they can come up with architectural type drawings. And so that went by the wayside. And then I thought, maybe I should become a medical illustrator instead, because that's sort of precise, and I like doing precise work and all that. And then I found out that you really have to do everything very accurately, and you're not allowed to be creative. You have to be really. So I said, oh, that's not for me either. And then little by little, I started painting, and one thing led to another. And then Kurt Lowasser came along, and he took me and said, okay, here's a stone. This is a lithographic stone, a Bavarian limestone. And he said, why don't you try it out? So I said, okay. And I did something really silly, a coat of arms, that family coat of arms. I said, gee, I could give these to all my relatives. And it was really something I tell people what not to do now these days, because printmaking is not meant to make copies, not meant to make reproductions of things. It's meant as a form of expression. And so after I finished that, he said to me, well, now that you have that out of your system, let's get down to something serious. And so that's when it all started out. And I grained these lithographic stones and drew on them and got to be pretty good at it. And that's what led me to the job of working with some of these other people on Long Island, the pretty big heavy hitters.
Well, I'm glad that you became a printmaker, and not because I don't like competition. Although I'm sorry to break it to you, but architecture's dirty little secret is that everyone believes that you have to do a lot of mathematics, but in truth, if you can do basic algebra, that's really most of the time all you need.
Well, that's probably even beyond me, basic algebra, because I just have a block against it. So, but I have ways of figuring things out mathematically without pencil and paper. Just it becomes more of a visual language that I can look at something. In fact, you know, this thing, this project that I'm intrigued with right now in terms of building this whale press is very architectural in a way, and it's very mathematical in a way, and it's very scientific, extremely scientific. So, there's this whole marriage between art and science.
What are you calling it? A whale press?
A whale press, yeah. I was on Nantucket Island and giving a workshop, and one of my former students said, you know, Dan, you have to come look at my mural that I did here. I said, oh, okay, let's go. So we went to the Whaling Museum, and I totally forgot to look at her mural because I saw this big, big machine there that was made out of beams and huge, monstrous beams that they would use in the form of a 32-foot long beam that would be lifted up from one end by a pulley, and the other end would be pressing down the whale fat blubber and make oils out of this thing. I said, gee, what a great tool this is for making prints. So I got so excited about this, and I said, yeah, I want to build one of these things. So now I'm in process of building one of these. It's not going to be a replica of it, but it's going to be taken from that idea, and it's going to have my own little devices in it that'll be very beautiful. It's going to be a very beautiful kind of science project, so to say, and it's going to have all kinds of interesting things on it. I have two hickory trees that we're going to put together and get a blacksmith and tie them together for the weight. And then I was supposed to get a hold of a big giant wooden screw and then a fulcrum. And we're going to do all sorts of things with this thing, maybe even do carvings on the side that look like a Maori war canoe that give it a sense of beauty, and tie these beams together with hand blacksmithing. I'd love to film the whole thing. We're starting to do a little bit of it.
Yeah, you should. It sounds like a huge piece of scrimshaw, actually.
Yeah.
Well, now I understand why you need a super huge big studio.
Right.
Earlier in the week, by the way, if you've just logged in, we're speaking with Dan Weldon, who's a master printmaker. This is Burning on the House on Heritage Radio Network. Earlier this week, I was there at Dan's, I think of it as sort of a ranch, although that seems like the wrong word, considering your property is a forest, but it has a ranch-like feeling to me with your various structures and so forth. And we were looking at the foundation for a very large, it's going to be a studio and a gallery and a counseling sort of retreat space on the top. So now I understand why you need that really big space for your whale press.
Well, yes and no. I mean, the whale press, the whale press is simply something that is totally, totally impractical, and it's not going to be useful, functional in most ways, shapes, or forms, but it'll be something that will be very beautiful, and it'll create a spectacle, and it'll be a very exciting thing to use and utilize in at times, but it would be such a beast to operate, and but it would probably take numerous people and, oh gosh, probably, you know, like a print party type thing that would say, okay, what are we going to do with this and how are we going to hoist this beam up? And so it's going to be that type of an activity. And I think I'm going to have it mounted on a trailer, like an equipment trailer, so that I can take it around and make it somewhat portable. Maybe put it in a parade or something like that, you know. Get on an old leather apron and that type of thing. And
sounds like it wants to have wheels as part of its design.
Yes, yeah.
I don't know. That sounds really fascinating. Well, I was just thinking with a press with that much leverage, if you're talking about a 40-foot beam.
It's actually 25 feet long with the beams, the hickory trees that I have cut. It's funny how life goes. I'm planning on this, thinking about this press, and all of a sudden someone called up and said, Dan, can you use old hickory trees? They've been standing dead. I have to take them down. I have no use for them. I said, gee, how did you know? How does someone know? How did these things come about? And so Tom Mack called up, and he said, yeah, I've got them. Come on over. So we took them down. But I got dressed up with my farmer's bib overalls and took my axe and my two-man handsaw. And I had my friend Bill kind of photograph and take a little film of this event. And I started chopping it with the axe, you know, and, of course, the axe bounced right off of this hard hickory. Mm-hmm. But, you know, managed to get a couple of shots in there and then turn the camera off. And then we put the chainsaw on it, you know, turn the camera off, and then finished it up with the two-man saw, like we did this whole thing with the two-man saw. And they came down with a real crash. And so these are going to be the beam, two of them together, tied together with some iron.
Yeah, okay. Still in all, with that much leverage, it seems to me that you could do you could print on fairly thick sheet metal if you wanted to.
Probably, yeah.
And wouldn't that be interesting? A print, a relief print in metal.
That could work. It actually could work. You could probably. I've done things on lead. Of course, lead isn't very good to use because it's can be very toxic and hazardous. But lead works really. It's a very beautiful metal to work on. But I'd really rather work on handmade papers, some really nice thick handmade papers, because that would emboss beautifully.
Mm-hmm. And we're speaking with Dan Weldon, master printmaker. So as I understand, you've recently returned from a sort of retreat in China. Tell us about that.
Well, it was actually a residency, and it was a really fantastic time. I didn't know what I was supposed to go for. They said, we're going to honor you. And I said, oh, okay, and just make the reservations. We'll pay for the ticket when you get there. And I said, okay, and I didn't know what it was about, and there were several people also invited from other parts of the world. One person from Australia, one from South Africa, and then I roomed with a guy from Ireland, from Europe, and of course there were people from China. So there was one representative of each continent, and so they had this big biennial, and our works were included, and I gathered that was part of it, but I didn't know what I was in for, and so they asked me to give the speech for the opening ceremony. And this is now communist China, so you have to do what they tell you. So they wrote the speech for me, So I had to. They said you could edit it if you like. So which I made some grammatical changes, but you know they read it. And I read it, and then they read it, and then I read it, you know, went back and forth. But I have no idea what they said. They could have said anything. And it was really kind of interesting. But it was all nice stuff in any case, how beautiful it is here and how wonderful the people are and everything like that. So I was in front of a large audience, but we had a great time. So that was it. And I did a lot of work while I was there, too, because they have an incredible printmaking setup. I was able to create works. I created 13 different works in the month's time, and then we were able to edition them as well. I printed myself, and then plus I had about 8 assistants helping me.
Wow.
It was really nice. They're really good, too. Very, very good printers.
Huh.
And they don't have master printers.
No.
They're all in the same level. Yeah, they all work in the same. They all have an expertise. Some are a little bit better, but they're all on the same level. Whereas in the United States, we have what they call master printers.
And that would be you, right?
Well, I've been called that. I don't like the term because too many people are using it because it becomes involves an economic factor, and there's too many unqualified people who think they're master printers or have gotten titles or have been self-anointed, and so it becomes a little bit. I mean, the United States has 59 master chefs in an industry like food, and yet there's hundreds of master printers. So I think there's something a little bit wrong with that picture.
Who knew?
Who knew?
In our profession, in architecture, some of us have been egging each other on to do something about creating a higher class of license, a master architect license that would require some sort of really rigorous and advanced testing. It could not be an academic qualification, because in a way that's too easy. Social promotion even in graduate school level being rather rampant. So I understand what you're saying. Let's get back to that. The technical and the image making. I suppose that to a certain extent, the kind of print that you're going to make informs the kinds of forms that you can, or that are ideal for that sort of method. Or let me turn it around. Are there the kinds of images that you would make on if you're etching a plate that would give you an idea for something that you would do on a lithograph stone?
Well, I mean, this is an interesting question. I try not to think too technical at first. I try to think about my image and what I'm trying to do. And having developed this process on the solar plate, that plate is capable it enables me to do anything I want to. So I can do something that would look like a lithograph, a silkscreen print, an etching, or, you know, anything. It could look like a woodcut. It could have the texture of the woodcut if you wanted it to. It could look like a fine engraving if you wanted to. You could actually print money. Someone could counterfeit money if they really, you know, wanted to make it that way, because it's got that capability. Or they can print something just like a German expressionist, very crude and very rough and quite texturous. So it's got this capability. So what I do is I just work on an image, and sometimes I'll work on a film, like a piece of transparent film, or architectural film, and draw and paint. And then I'll look at it and say, okay, how am I going to treat this? And then I'll look at the plate and say, okay, I can do it this way or that way. And that comes in secondarily. The image making comes first.
I'm not really familiar with what this is. Tell us about solar plate. What is it?
Well, the solar plate is actually something that Kurt Lowasser put in my hand in 1970 or 71. And he said, hey, why don't you try this out? And it was a new product that was out on the market that was used for printing commercially. And I looked at it and I said, okay, you know, and it's used as a stamping device. So it would be inked up and stamped. And it's very crude and very rough in those days. And I turned it around. Instead of using it as a stamping process or as a what we would call a relief print or a something is printed off the high surface, I turned it around to do an etching. And since the solar plate, it's something solar being, you stick it out in the sun makes it hard. It hardens the material. Any place that it doesn't see the sun, it remains in its natural state. In other words, you could put something down between the sun and the plate, and then it blocks the sun. Expose the plate, and then all of a sudden you put some water, a cup full of water, and a little brush, a little nail brush or something, scrub-a-dub-dub, and all of a sudden you have an etching. Wherever you blocked it away, you have the water eats the plate material away. It's a polymer surface. It's a photopolymer.
Huh.
So you'd get a crater wherever it's eaten away, or a very, very fine line, very detailed or very broad, whatever the imagery looks like. So you could paint right on the thing if you wanted to, paint right on the plate, or you can make a film transparency and place that down, put it in contact, and expose it. So it's sort of hard to visualize this, just hearing the words. I love showing people, you know, demonstrating the process, and then people can say, "Oh, that's the way it is."
I think some of us of a certain age will understand, because it's very much like the diazo media that we used to use to make. In the first case was actual blueprints.
Right.
That had an emulsion, and once it was, and in the early days, they did use the sun to make these prints, but then that emulsion was developed with ammonia fumes, which made the task of making diazo prints particularly unpleasant. And the lowest-ranking person in an office usually had to do that. And even with really good ventilation, it was still a highly stinky kind of job to have to do. But, yeah, I understand. That's and you can get incredible resolution with that kind of method.
So then, and then the nice thing about it is you can make multiples of it. So once the image is made on the plate, you inked it up, and you can make 10 or 20 impressions from it.
But each one is going to be, or could be, different depending on how you ink it, right?
Absolutely right, yeah. Exactly what we're doing right now with Roy down in my basement. He's just actually working on something right now, and I said, well, I'm taking an hour break. And you work on this, and I'll come down, surprise me, and we'll come up with something nice.
So I have a question for you. This is just a nomenclature question. An acquaintance of mine who is a part-time artist makes things that are called monoprints. What is a monoprint?
Monoprint is a one-of-a-kind work that's done from a matrix. In other words, you could have a woodcut, an etching, a lithograph, and each time it's inked up differently. Rather than inking it up the same way each time, you do something different to it. You might change the background with another color, or, you know, just instead of making each one identical, each one becomes a unique work.
Mm.
And there's a monotype, which is something different entirely, and the words sometimes are interchangeable. The monotype is when you don't have a matrix and you're doing a painting or a drawing on a flat surface, like a piece of metal or a piece of plexiglass or plastic, and you do that image on that material, and you put your piece of paper on top of it and crank that through the press. You take it off, and it's a one-of-a-kind piece. It's a squashed painting. So there's no matrix in the case of the monotype, where the monoprint does have a matrix.
Huh, interesting. I wouldn't imagine that you could draw on plastic unless it had pretty good tooth to it, I suppose.
Well, you can make a tooth on it. I've done it with carborundum and taken a lithostone and graining it, and you can give it a nice tooth. And then just drawing it with a Swiss-made Caran d'Ache crayon. That's a water-soluble crayon, and dampen your paper and crank it through the press and lifts that crayon right off beautifully.
And there you go. Interesting. Yeah. How does it work when you're collaborating with another artist? I've seen some Rauschenberg prints, and they're very large. How's the division of labor go in a case like that?
Well, when I printed for Rauschenberg, I was very lowly, and that's I was the ammonia-smelling person. So in that, I was a young printer, and Rauschenberg would come in, and he'd have his wonderful ideas. He was just a terrific guy, and he'd say, "Well, first thing we've got to do is go to the supermarket." So he would go to the supermarket and get a whole bunch of cardboard boxes, which were what he was planning on using as his way of making his art. So what he did was he took the cardboard boxes and we made them, inked them up, and transferred that cardboard box shape onto the lithographic stone. And then that became the image. And then another stone with the same thing, and another. We actually did three stones with three of the same cardboard boxes, printing one in tan, another one in light tan, another one in dark tan. So that was the way that print evolved. And that was Rauschenberg. And then his other people, David Sally, who worked with a couple of years back, and he did a drawing on his own, on a piece of Mylar, on a piece of film, and we brought it here, and I looked at it, and I said, okay, we can do this very simply. We made a plate right from that film, and it worked out. Eric Fischel, on the other hand, is probably the most influential person in the development of the solar plate process with me, because he was there right from the beginning. When we started doing these things that involved his trials, one trial after another, after another, after another, and he just had the patience, lots and lots of patience, to go through all the different trials. And then finally we succeeded, and it was like magic when all of a sudden it succeeded. We came out with these wonderful prints of his figures. He did figure drawings, and quite beautiful, too. We wound up talking about it on a panel at the College Art Association convention back in, early 90s. And what was interesting was I showed all the examples of the failures to the audience, and then, of course, the successful ones at the end. But the audience had a real appreciation for, gee, what does this really take to go through one thing to the next, to the next, to the next, to finally end up with the final end, the masterpieces at the end.
Interesting.
So
these were drawings. These weren't paintings or.
Well, they were paintings in a sense, because they were done in black and white with a brush, or sometimes he'd use a T-shirt and just smear ink around in the form of a figure and take the back of the brush and remove it. And he would do that on film or on glass. I like working on glass, actually, because glass is a very nice transparent material that you can make it rough or smooth, or you can use it in its natural state. And that becomes a real nice drawing surface or a painting surface and for the solar plate.
Interesting. I had never really much thought
of... Well, it's so forgiving, because you put a mark on a piece of glass, you just wipe it off if you don't like it.
That's one of the reasons that we used to like drawing on Mylar.
Right.
The same kind of Mylar that you're using. Because even if you're drawing in ink, just... I hate to admit this, but I mean, look, we all know what goes on in an art studio. It's It's down and dirty. We just lick an eraser and just, you know, wet erase the ink, and it just come right off.
Mm-hmm.
Extremely forgiving.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite.
I like ink on paper.
Ink on paper is not forgiving.
No.
That was part of the
Especially when you went to school, when I did, with using, we didn't have rapidograph pens. We had ruling pens. You know, if you remember those, right?
I started out,
With dripping the India ink in this little thing that you squeeze tighter and tighter, like, so you got the right line weight. And then, of course, that ink would run underneath your straight edge and make a mess, right?
It's really quite a demanding discipline to be able to draw with a ruling pen, but that's what people had for 150 years.
The only thing they had, you even put them into a compass and drew circles like that, right? It was wonderful. Yeah, it was really great, beautiful line content.
Yes, once you mastered, you know, how much or how little ink to put between those two. I mean, I'd use a dropper.
Yep.
To put just the right amount of ink so that you'd have just the amount of surface tension in between those blades of the nib so that you didn't have too much, you didn't run out in the middle of a line or something like that.
But it's funny because I was giving a workshop and had a student in the class. She was a young girl and she said, "What is this tool? I got it at a yard sale." I said, "Oh, that's a ruling pen, you know. Well, how do you use it? You know, do you scratch with it?" No. So I showed her how to use it, and she was just so blown away with, "Oh, this is so beautiful." You know, it's something it is really a treasure to try to use one of those things and to learn to use it properly. She just had such a good time.
You're right. The quality of line actually is, and I think everyone would agree, no one would really argue, is superior to a rapidograph.
Mm-hmm.
There's a way that a line with a ruling pen fades in and then fades out at the ends of the line, mm-hmm. which with a round point rapidograph style pen is extremely precise. You know, it begins where it begins and it ends where it ends, and it's, you know, it has a finality to it that a ruling pen line does not have. The rapidograph on Strathmore board was the required medium for architectural drawings in the first year when I was in college. And that means that you had to draw each drawing twice. You had to draw it first in graphite, very lightly, and then you had to ink over it. And even with a rapidograph, it's very easy to end up with ink under your straight edge. At the cost of Strathmore board, even in the 1970s, it was expensive. Are you mostly doing solar plate prints these days?
When I was in China, that's what I did because it was a new thing for them, and I like to share it. Plus, it's very fast and very spontaneous and convenient. And for the most part, that's what I've been doing because I'm sort of, you know, it's my baby. I love painting and I love drawing, so it really doesn't matter if it's a solar plate, if it's a stone lithograph. I did some stone lithographs while I was in China, too, but I combined them with solar plates. Sometimes I'll combine a mixed media. I did a screen print combined with the stone lithograph. So, I mean, just mixing things all according to what I feel like or all according to what the work is looking to have more of, I'll incorporate the technique that'll do it justice.
So if you can achieve the same sort of quality of line and a void that you would have in a woodblock cut print in solar plate, why would anybody want to be working in wood?
That's a good question. And looking at the Chinese working in the Guanlan print base, or anyone looking at these people working over there, they would be in awe because they're so steeped into the woodcut tradition. I was watching this one guy take, he was working on a piece of plywood that was about 4 by 8 feet, and he was working with 2 chisels, one in each hand, and he was cutting away. And I was just, my jaw dropped because he was so incredibly skilled, and he was just creating as he was cutting this wood. You know, he wasn't working after a pattern or after anything else. He was just carving away, and I said, oh, my gosh. The guy was, he was brilliant. So a lot of this is done because this is truly a hands-on process. I love calling it woodcut, the honest medium, because there's no, just, there's nothing else involved. I mean, there's no computers involved in it. There's no other people involved. You got to cut your, well, I mean, you could have somebody else cut your wood if you wanted to, but it's still a woodcut where other things and other printmaking techniques can be abused today, especially with the new technologies involving digital. There's nothing wrong with the new technologies, but lots of people don't necessarily call them what they are. They like to use the old terms and say, you know, this is an original print, when it's really not necessarily an original print. It's a reproduction or it's a poster. So these are things that sometimes people don't know, especially the buyer doesn't know that, know these things.
Yeah. Yeah, I've noticed in some galleries an increasing amount of digital printing on, you know, on stuff other than paper, where it might be a photographic image that's been manipulated and then run through a very large format.
Well, there's nothing wrong with these things as long as people are calling them what they are.
Uh-huh.
That if people want to say this is a digital print on nylon or silk or somebody's underwear, that's fine. You know, it's whatever it is. But if it's a woodcut and they say this is a woodcut, then that's what that is. So anything's okay as long as you people know what it is. What gets to be a little bit funny is when it's not really known and people just call it a print and they don't know what kind of print it is.
Yeah. I think what you're getting at, talking about woodcutting, is something that we often discuss in architecture, which is the demonstrable difference of outcome when doing a drawing by hand, in some cases without using any instruments, which requires a certain amount of control over your line, as compared with a digitally produced architectural drawing.
Well, that's true, and we could take that to all kinds of degrees. I mean, the photographer, for example, the darkroom photographer will say, well, my silver photograph is still a little bit better than the digital photograph. So, I mean, they're the ones that can see it because they're working in the darkroom. You know, and it does have the mechanical sense about it when you're looking at a real silver print.
Well, of course.
It's true all the way through, from...
Well, yeah, but, yeah, go ahead.
You know, it's just one of these things that's today. It's not going to be replaced. It's just going to get improved more and more. And I'm just one of these old-fashioned people that does not want to see the hands replaced. People have got to use the hands. I gave a little thing in high school just this week, and I was very surprised at the kids because I thought they'd all be coming in with digital things that they want to do. And well, they were really just so terrific. This was in Smithtown. And they just really ate this process up, hook, line, and sinker. They loved getting their hands into it. And there was no computer work in it at all. And it was just wonderful. And you could see the joy that they all had. They got really lots and lots of fun out of it. They had a good time.
That's great. I'm not surprised by that at all, Dan. A lot of the younger cohort of intern architects that I've worked with over the last few years, because they grew up with the personal computer being a given. I mean, some of these kids are of an age that computers have always been around, and they learned how to touch type instead of learning how to write, you know, proper cursive script, for example, are fascinated by the idea of hand drawing. In many cases, they were not required to do any drawing in their architecture schools. And so, in fact, some of them really can't draw, or at least not very well, because as we know, the only way to learn how to draw is to draw.
Mm-hmm.
And do it again, and learn how to control your chosen medium. So I'm not surprised at all. I think that the analog world of, to my mind, real drawing and real painting and even real darkroom photography is poised for possibly all of these things will have a huge revival in this coming century. At least I hope so.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I think today's world too. Today, it's interesting. So many people put up a wall, and they actually stop themselves because they have these expectations, and they can't go further than what their mind tells them. You know, they just say, "I can't draw. I can't do any of this." And I love those kinds of people actually because I love to prove them wrong. they first of all have this image of what a drawing is supposed to be or something that they should do rather than something that they can do. Mm. And so many times, this is the educator in me coming out or the counselor or whatever you want, but I take people like this and say, okay, let's try this out. I had a woman come and to assist me, and she says, I don't want to do the process. I said, well, we'll see. And I said, okay, it's time for you to do it. Oh, no, I can't do it. Yes, you can. You know, went back and forth. And finally, you know, I took her by her mind in a way and try to change it and try to relax her and I tried to get her to play. And it actually worked. And she came out with a piece that was just, you know, she cried out of such being so joyful about the end result. I mean, her tears were, you know, just, oh, my gosh, I never knew I could do anything like this. And it's such a fun, too, when you're working with printmaking because it's not one of those activities that it's not like painting or drawing where you see what you're going to get. There are times where you have to wait. And then when you wait and wait and wait and then you ink this thing up and you put your piece of paper down on top of it and crank it through the press and the heart starts beating more and more and louder and then you unveil that piece of paper from the press, and all of a sudden, it's wow! It's a climactic moment that you know it is that wow moment, and it's a surprise. So it's not exactly what people anticipate. Number one, it's backwards, so it's not the exact same thing as they put down. It comes out totally backwards, so it takes a little bit of the edge off of things when they know it's not going to come out exactly right.
Yeah, but that is one of the things that we used to have in our favor in architecture, because we were always drawing on a semi-transparent surface,
mm-hmm.
and you could turn it over, and you'd see its mirror image,
right?
And sometimes you would see something totally unexpected that you hadn't noticed before because you hadn't really seen the gestalt of your drawing. You'd only seen the details of it.
I think it's especially important in your design stage too.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, because when you start drawing, you just never know what ideas are going to come along, and it becomes additive. And you might put another layer over and redraw, but in each, you know, it's like that saying that you can never step in the same river twice because you have changed and the river has changed. When you do another layer and you draw over, it's going to be a different drawing. And
yeah, for sure.
And and sometimes happy mistakes happen. And you will, you might find that you're tired of that line, and so you're not going to do that line again. You're going to do something else. You're going to form the space that you're trying to describe in a different way, yeah. Which is why I frequently like to come back to the notion that all arts inform each other, or they should, at their best. Wow, you know, we're almost out of our allotted time. This has been really fascinating. We've been speaking with Dan Weldon, master printmaker, authentically master printmaker. If you'd like to plug your website, here's your opportunity. Dan?
Well, okay, I'll plug my website.
Yeah.
it's Dan Weldon, Weldon.
.com. Very good. Do you have any upcoming exhibitions or anything to show your work?
I do. I have two up in upstate New York in two different locations. One will be at the BCB Gallery in Hudson, New York. And that'll be coming up, I think, in March or April or something. And then the other one will be this summer in Windsor, New York, at Windsor Whip Works Gallery. So it's an old buggy whip factory that was converted into a gallery.
Nice.
But the BCB Gallery is run by Bruce Bergman, who was a former student of mine back in the 70s. And the other one is, it's really hopefully going to be a nice exhibition of the works that I did in China.
Very nice. Very good. Well, this has been a real pleasure, Dan. And
it's been a pleasure for me, too, Curtis. I appreciate it, too.
And if you have any more questions about your studio, you know how to find me.
Okay, yeah.
All right, thanks.
So I will leave you with one parting sentence. Only art and science can elevate us to a higher form of living.
Amen.
And that's from Beethoven.
Excellent.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
This has been Burning Down the House for 13th of January 2013. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. We've been speaking with Dan Weldon. Thank you for listening. Keep the faith.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.